Welcome to In Conversation with David Goa. I'm pleased to be joined by Pastor Donald Schoberg for this ongoing series of conversations on the Ecclesia. Bishop Schoberg was born in 1930, farm near Clanwilliam, Manitoba. His early life was shaped by the Swedish immigrant community and Bethlehem Lutheran Church in Erickson, Manitoba. He studied at Luther College in Regina and at the University of Saskatoon, where he was a part of the Lutheran student movement. For a decade and a half, he served as national bishop for the Evangelical Lutheran Church of Canada, retiring from that position in 1993. I met Bishop Schoberg in the early 1970s when he was president of the Western Canada Synod. I was developing the Spiritual Life Sacred Ritual Gallery at the Provincial Museum of Alberta and sought him out for conversation on Lutheran worship. Our conversation ranged widely, and I learned about various Lutheran initiatives, including work between the ELCIC and the Lutheran Church of Canada, Missouri Synod, to produce a joint service book. Bishop Schoberg's childhood formation, his broad-ranging experience in Lutheran congregations throughout Canada and internationally, and his work as national bishop has given him a particular vantage point from which to reflect on the church over the last 7 decades. It is a blessing to be given the long view when it comes to the life of the church. Welcome to our conversation. So I'm in the home of Bishop Schoberg,
mm-hmm.
And it's the 19th of September. And I wanted to talk with you about the Ecclesia, the gathered community of the faithful, and to think with you a little bit about it. You served as a pastor and the national bishop for the Evangelical Lutheran Church of Canada for a number of years. So maybe just to set the context, you grew up in Manitoba, is that correct?
Well, I grew up until I was 17, and then I left for university.
Where did you go to university?
First year in Luther College, Regina. And then University of Saskatchewan.
And what year?
The Luther College Regina was in 1948.
Right after the war.
Yeah.
And did you go from college to seminary?
There was an arrangement in Saskatoon, Lutheran College and Seminary, whereby for arts degree students, you could use some of the classes from the seminary, which counted towards your Bachelor of Arts.
Oh, history, for example?
It was church history, mm-hmm. Yes, was one of them, yes.
Who were your professors?
The dogmatics teacher and church historian was Conrad Gleiner.
Ah.
Yes.
So did you go from Luther College in Regina to the seminary in Saskatoon?
I did, unexpectedly. I'd basically gone to Luther College trying to figure what I was going to do. Completing grade 12, I received, to my surprise, a letter from the Department of Education, Manitoba, saying that I could have a position as a teacher of a one-room school in northern Manitoba.
Well, this is in part, is it in part because the war was over and they were seeking teachers because of the baby boom?
I'm not sure. I never did explore that, but they evidently felt that they were in such need that a student just completing grade 12 could be entrusted mm-hmm. with grades from 1 to and probably 9 by correspondence. I attended a one-room school, so I knew fully well what that entailed. And so thankfully, I had the pastor, my home pastor, said, you should go to Luther College Regina.
Who was that?
George Nelson, from the States.
Yeah. And what was the church?
The church was of Augustana, Synod Augustana Church, and one of the historic churches in Canada.
Located?
Located in Erickson, Manitoba.
In Erickson, the heart of the Swedish world.
One of the hearts.
One of the hearts. It has many hearts. And then you went to seminary?
Luther College Regina was a seminary of the Augustana, of the American Lutheran Church. And to my surprise, in first year university, I met fellow students there who were going to become pastors. I had no thought of becoming a pastor, none whatsoever. And these were young men who were quite pleased to be on that road. And it amazed me that it, and so we became friends. And I basically followed them because they said, we're going to Saskatoon and we can stay at the Lutheran College and Seminary. There's a house there that, and so I just followed them. And I ended up taking seminary classes and as well as university. And I just followed along because I was interested and I enjoyed their company. We had a great time. It was my first experience with any Lutherans other than those of Augustana background.
So you had to deal with a few Norwegians and a few Danes, maybe?
And principally in the Luther College and Seminary, Lutheran College and Seminary, They were of German background.
They were German. Yeah.
There was a separate seminary for that had just been recently formed. There was cooperation until about 1947, 48. But then there, all along there was the decision that they would want to have their own seminary. They meaning the Norwegian Lutheran Church.
Norwegians are like that. You know.
Well, it was, I think, very much an aspect of the piety aspect, yeah. And there was a big consideration.
Yeah, the influence of pietism was marked in those years.
But I have to say that I had appreciation for that because I had grandmothers who were Swedish background pietist movement. Very much influenced by that. And my one grandmother really liked to go to the Baptist church, the Swedish Baptist church. She liked their hymns much better. And she had a paper from the Mission Covenant.
Right, yeah. Well, my family, you know, both my mother and father come from Norway.
Yeah.
My father's family was quite deeply influenced by pietism. And by Hans Nielsen Hauge. One of his uncles and his cousin became the editors of the Stavanger Aftenblad, which was an instrument for pietism in the transformation, the modern transformation of Norway. So the pietism was there in my father. He had said to me, however, that he left Norway when he was 19 to get away from his mother and to get away from God. But he ended up meeting God on the prairies here in Canada. And pietism was a deep part of his sensibility. I have always thought of him as being a bit unusual. This is when I read about pietism and what have you, because he managed to understand the difference between pietism and Great Plains fundamentalism, which captured so much of the pietist world in North America. And he had a little touch of the mystical tradition that you find in pietism in him as well. So I'm grateful for that tradition. When I was a boy, my family left Calvary Lutheran Church. A good pietist struggle with the minister was behind it, I think. And we started to attend the newly built Evangelical Mission Covenant Church, which was in King Edward Park, four blocks from our house. So I grew up with that covenant element. And I ended up going to North Park College, which they founded in Chicago as well.
Where did you?
So I'm very familiar with that that part of church history, and I appreciate its gifts, and I think I understand some of its Achilles heels. When were you ordained?
1954.
And where did that occur?
Exception had been made by the Augustana Lutheran Synod for Canadians attending Lutheran College and Seminary in Saskatoon. So in 1952, the Canadians could be ordained in Canada, in their home congregation or wherever. So there were two brothers, Paul and Harold Erickson, who were ordained in 1952.
Yeah.
1953, Alf Sander and my cousin, Vern Sunmark, were ordained in Canada. I also could have been ordained in 1953, but I chose to wait a year. And so I got married, and my wife and I went on an extended honeymoon in Europe for 3.5 months, which took me out of the sequence of colloquy and proper approval to be ordained, which the Augustana Synod did at Rock Island Seminary.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that is why I was ordained in 54 and not 53.
Were you ordained in your home parish?
My home parish.
In Erickson.
Yeah. There were 83 ordained that year in the Augustana Ministerium.
My oh my.
And I was the sole one ordained in Canada. But we were reminded that we're ordained in the church by President Oscar Benson. Came from the States.
From Rock Island.
At the time, the office was in Minneapolis.
Minneapolis.
But the representative of the seminary in Rock Island was there, clergy and so forth. And you were reminded in the rite of ordination that you are ordained into the church and not a local church, local congregation.
And by the church, so you're making a distinction. You were reminded that this is not simply about the local, it's about the Augustana Synod,
yeah.
I assume. Did church mean the Augustana Synod? Did it mean, yes, the Augustana Synod, but something more than that as well? What's your sense of how that was understood?
I think at that time it was basically the Augustana Synod,
mm-hmm.
yes. And there were other things that supported that, the language, and a bit of the culture.
Mm-hmm.
And the Augustana had a great emphasis on liturgy, and was kind of regarded as high church. And
for my mother, she would have regarded you as, you know, quasi-Catholic.
Yes.
Yeah. I've always been charmed by how the Swedish Lutheran Church retained apostolic succession.
Yes.
Because Swedes at the time of the Reformation, or before the time of the Reformation, Swedes would have then still, the few that could do this, wouldn't mind going to Italy for a vacation, but it was a big journey. But no Italian would want to really go to Sweden, maybe to Germany, but Sweden's a bit too far. So you end up, before the Reformation having Swedish bishops in Sweden. I'm not telling you anything you don't know, but I'm amusing myself a little bit here. So then at the Reformation, when Luther threw the gauntlet down, my understanding is that virtually all of the bishops in Germany left and went, you know, over that period of struggle, went back to Italy. The Swedish bishops couldn't really do that. It was too far. They weren't inclined to do it. A holiday, yes, but really were Swedish. So one of the ironies of church history to me is that the Swedish Lutheran Church continues to have apostolic succession to this day because all of those bishops were ordained by bishops all the way back to the apostles.
Yeah.
Do you have apostolic succession?
I do, but I tend to think of it as the succession of faith rather than the tactile touch.
Yes.
But it is in the, for Anglican sisters and brothers, a significant thing of continuity. And yes, it is there. But interesting thing occurred at the installation of the new bishop of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in the U.S. I've been asked to speak at his installation.
When was this?
This is in 1988, something like that. There's Chilstrom, Bishop Chilstrom. And there was a bit of fervor as we were getting ready for the service and couldn't figure out what the rumbling was because normally, or they had arranged for the three churches merging, that the bishops of the three churches would do the laying on of hands.
So these three churches are?
Would be the American Lutheran Church, Lutheran Church in America, and then the breakaway group from the Missouri Synod.
Ah, yes.
And, but Chilstrom had felt that he wanted a European connection, particularly from Europe and Namibia. He chose the bishop from Namibia, one of the bishops, and a bishop from Sweden.
Mm-hmm.
And the faculty, I think, they were the main from Luther Seminary in St. Paul felt that what does this mean? What is being done here? And so there was a consternation, and the bishop from Germany. We said, what is, it's the faith, it's not that, what's the problem? You know, he saw no problem in it. But I say others felt that, what does this mean?
So what was their, what did they think it might mean that concerned them?
That we're doing something here that we've not thought through. And the former bishop of the Lutheran Church in America, Bob Marshall. I talked to him at the time, and I value his perspective. He said, I agree. I agree that there is a tendency to throw in the ceremonial act without due process to allow people to really answer the Lutheran question, what does this mean? And he said yes. So the invitation to the three bishops, Hanselmann from Germany, and I forget the other names right now, they were told and they understood and politely did not go forward for the laying on of hands. Curiously, I heard that when bishops from Sweden were invited to a consecration, a service of a bishop, they have somebody that stands in the way, potential way of the Swedish bishop from going forward to lay hands, lest this symbolism be misunderstood. So it's strange. There's no problem in Estonia and Latvia. Well, it's, I should say, their bishops have all been consecrated with the bishop from Sweden lay present, so that they might have that connection.
So is this part of the shadow of the Reformation? Do you see it as a concern? You talked about the Lutheran question. It's lovely to hear you pose the Lutheran question of what does this mean? The shadow which says that the Catholic Church at the time of the Reformation had a kind of tragic decadence to it associated with a number of things that Luther took exception to and tried to reform, and then ended up being banished, and we get the Reformation. One of those is one of those, let me ask you, is one of those a concern that the formalism of apostolic succession becomes a dead letter when it is not understood and the meaning of it is not deeply understood both by the person who's being ordained as well as by the community in which they're being ordained? So in the Reformation, you know this better than I, there was a deep concern that priests would be engaged in their sacramental offices without, at least apparently, without a proper understanding and a deep relationship to the faith. And of course, pietism has this reaction to the state church in Sweden, as well as in Norway. And you get that pietist legacy as well, which becomes quite anti-clerical. So let me ask it this way. At that gathering, is there the shadow of the struggles of the Reformation vis-a-vis Rome and the notion of apostolic succession? Is there a bit of the shadow of pietists, anti-clericalism, and not wanting to extend that even to the point of seeing the ordination and the episcopal office as participating in a tradition which is deemed more problematic than life-giving? Or am I going down a rabbit hole?
Yes. Well, it is something that maybe it was not intended to be, and there gets to be upmanship, one up on the mm-hmm. other. And it becomes dividing. Mm-hmm. And while it was meant to be in the tradition and so forth, yet there's something else is evolving in terms of the understanding of it. And it as Bishop Hanselmann from Germany said at that installation time service, it is the faith. It's the faith yeah. that and not a tactile thing. And so we get sidetracked. It may be, I meant Archbishop Ronce, I was privileged to join an ecumenical group in Europe and to different centers we visited. One was Canterbury. And listening to the history there and all that's attached. And it's very impressive. And so I made a comment to him about that and this rich history you have. He said, yes, indeed. But in some sense, we're also encumbered by it. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was an insight. Mm-hmm. That in what way does it enable us to be mm-hmm. the church mm-hmm. and to be kind of more flexible? And mm-hmm. what way is it in encumbrance?
Well, this is always such a curious matter, isn't it? I became friends with Yaroslav Pelikan, and Yaroslav Pelikan used to love to say, tradition is the living faith of the dead. Traditionalism, the dead faith of the living. And so tradition has amazing capacities and gives us a lot to feed our understanding when it is living, when it is vital. In the last week of my father's life, back in 1969, he talked with me about having moved from the Lutheran Church to the Covenant Church. And he said that it's not exactly that he regretted it, but he had come to understand in a deeper way the danger of a church becoming like the Covenant Church, non-creedal. And he regretted that he hadn't understood that better earlier. So that is another example of a place where there is a tradition which can provide some authority and some center as well as some circumference. When it's abused, people can cast it out, which is what Pietists did. But 100 years later, you can find yourself a little bit at sea because you don't have it. So some of these aspects of tradition seem to me to function as rudders and sails. And they're not the boat, as I think your phrase or the phrase of your colleague when he says it's about the faith, is pointing out. But they can be awfully significant as well. When you were a young pastor, or even before that, what were you taught about the nature of the church? Who is she? What is the ecclesia?
I have to say, no. Church history was taught in just facts kind of thing, but not in the sense as to its kind of the biblical ecclesia. It mm-hmm. was the organizational aspect of it. And at the time in the seminary, at least at Saskatoon, dogmatics taught by Kleiner, who was from Germany. And it was, his motto was repetitio mater studiorum est. Mm-hmm. Repetition is the mother of learning.
Yeah.
And if we fed back exactly word for word what he said, that was all he wanted. And it was the time in which To be properly Lutheran, you had to pretty well stick to the script, and you were watched very carefully in that regard, too. And as long as you stack to the old traditional script, and I think that was true for most churches at the time.
Well, in part, being here in North America, they're in a world of competition, religious competition. Because when you're surrounded by the whole of the Christian family, which often defines itself as family arguments, this issue of wanting to be sure that you know who belongs and who doesn't, even though they have the same scripture, becomes heightened, I think. Yes. Now that's I'm not surprised to hear you say that, but I I did want to hear it a bit. What about when did you begin to serve a parish, a church?
We were in such desperate need in the Augustana Synod Canada Conference for pastors, having about 40 to 50 congregations and maybe 6 to 8 pastors.
Oh my.
That as soon as I was in Saskatoon, second year university, but also taking seminary classes, 2 seminary classes, I was considered by the president of the Canada Conference as a suitable person to go out and to lead a service. So my first service was when I was 18 years of age and out to Czar and Hughenden, Alberta.
Oh, Czar and Hughenden. Do you remember the text of your first sermon?
I just remember my fear. I stood in the pulpit. You were to follow the order of service. Mm-hmm. In the general prayer, I was told that an exception had been made in the general prayer and that I was to know that because one of the members of the congregation would strenuously, vocally object if you used one word in that prayer, that the now could be changed. And the word was, instead of lawful, you had to say honorable. Because the prayer was for all lawful occupations. And that would include the beer parlor.
Yes.
And this one man had sometimes upset a pew. They claimed he had broken the window. And so I was having my first service there, and I wondered, as I stood in the pulpit, is he here today? And when I was preaching, so-called preaching, I guess, it was more a Bible study, I think. Anyway, I was following the text, and I heard a noise in the narthex, and the door swung open, and this lady came and sat right below me. There was still a noise out there, and he was getting out of his overalls, I think, and getting into his suit. Don't sound that way. And he came and sat beside her, folded his arms like this, and looked up at me. And that was the man.
That is charming.
But I come to appreciate him, mm-hmm. and the family, mm-hmm. and understand where he was coming yeah. from and so forth.
Well, it comes from some kind of pain, I expect.
Yeah. So I do not say that or tell that story without mm-hmm. noting that I come mm-hmm. to mm-hmm. see where he was coming
yeah.
from.
Yeah, yeah. Well, when you think of the the great struggles associated with alcohol on the prairies, other places too, but certainly on the prairies with the settlement period. My father was a teetotaler because his father had, I think, in Norway, had drank too much, and it had led to struggles and what have you. So it's understandable how it happened on the prairies, and it's curious. We don't often think of it these days, but, you know, the temperance movement is also part of the women's movement.
And, absolutely.
And they had good reasons, wanting to bring some more order and a little more responsibility into their families.
Members of the congregation of Augustana were very much involved in the temperance movement.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah, very much. And it was led by the women, of course.
Yeah.
And understandably so, yeah.
As you served churches, how long were you a pastor?
I was a pastor of Augustana in Edmonton, my first congregation, for 6 years. And I received at that time a call to be the director for Canadian missions. That is, included starting new congregations and also support for existing congregations that could not afford a pastor. And so that was my work in the Augustana Synod, and then with the merger of the new church.
And the merger occurred?
62,
and that brought together Augustana and various other synods.
Yes, the United Lutheran Church in America, and then also the Finnish mm-hmm, Church mm-hmm. was involved in that.
So a number of the churches.
And the Danish background mm-hmm. church.
So a number of the churches that had a kind of folk base, ethnic base, they realized it was time for them to get together.
Yeah.
And by that time, English had become somewhat ubiquitous.
Oh, yes.
And their sense of being citizens of Canada had shifted as well.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose, yeah.
So I only had one regular call to a congregation.
In the Augustana Synod.
And in the Lutheran Church in America, I was never called. I went from Augustana pastor and then to the director of Canadian missions in two churches, and then I was synodical bishop for 15 years, and then I was a national bishop.
But you were synodical bishop in the new church?
The Lutheran Church in America.
Lutheran Church in America.
And then the Canadian church merger, then I was the national bishop.
And the Canadian church was called?
Evangelical Lutheran Church in Canada.
In Canada, yeah. ELCIC. And you were the national bishop from when to when?
I was elected to the Constituting Convention in 1985.
Constituting Convention.
Yeah. And then I retired in 1993.
Mm-hmm.
And then I wasn't wanting to retire as a pastor, and so I was privileged to do a lot of interims in congregations, feeling that I had not done my due in the real work in the congregations.
Pastoral work.
Yes,
yeah.
And so I that was my intention. I had had enough of the administrative and the overall kind of responsibility in the meetings, and I wanted just to be in one place.
When you were national bishop, I mean, this is I don't know how much you've thought about this, so I don't mean to Well, I'd just like to think with you a little bit about it. As the national bishop, what did you come to think? About the church. I'll ask the old question. Yeah. Who was she for you when you were national bishop? How did you understand these gatherings all across the country with a variety of things going on at different times? What did you see? Let me ask it this way. What did you see as its gifts?
As a gift. The gift are the people, mm-hmm. the baptized. And so in the definition of the church, we struggle with that in the formation of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in Canada. From the LCA tradition, Lutheran Church in America, and Augustana tradition, it was seen as the ministerium and congregations recognized by this church. Congregations was not individuals. And this was a sense to kind of emphasize sort of the church at large a little bit as well.
So let me just push that a little bit to be sure I'm understanding. It's the ministerium and the congregations.
Yeah.
So this is a way of bringing an emphasis which doesn't devolve into individualism.
Correct.
I see.
So now in the Luther Merger Commission, which was responsible then to work through the details of the merger, how shall we define this church? And
you were part of those discussions?
Yes, yeah. For years, yeah. Years and years. And Dr. Hordern, who was president of Lutheran College, Lutheran Theological Seminary in Saskatoon, mm-hmm. Proposed that why not consider that this church is the baptized members in congregations recognized by this church.
The baptized members in congregations recognized by
this church.
This church. So that's a way of trying to hold two things together.
It was an interesting concept. And here I'm not familiar with what occurred, but it was in the charter, the incorporation. But then I think there gets to be a problem of a functioning corporation if the individual members have a direct vote in the proceedings, which we had not thought through, which went through our legal authorities at the time. But while it was a theological concept, it may not have worked corporately in the world.
Well, that's interesting, isn't it? Canadian law. So what happened?
It was changed. The Constitution changed, so this church is the congregations that are recognized. And we don't have the ministerium then. That went out. But, mm-hmm. but I think theologically, I really like the concept of what we had. Because if we think in those terms, then we come back to each individual is kind of recognized as the role as the baptized. And what does it mean to be the baptized? As we understanding that you're part of a community, you attend worship, and you see yourself as, yes, carrying the gospel. You see yourself as involved. And what is this national organization, or the organization that we have? It should surely be to support them in the gathering of the baptized for worship and all that can enhance that worship and also that can send them and support them, they are in the real world. They are the best able to witness in this world. So why not hold it high? And I love that. I saw that when the proposal was made as a potential for us, but I had not wrestled with the corporate aspect of it. But that theologically, I see that as so essential. And individualism, yes, but you can think of in as the baptized. Yeah, what better way of support for them? Yes, and the church at large, as we call it at large, is an expression through the national bishop. I'm one of our synodical bishops said to me, as I was saying, now what is my role? Because their role was very clearly in a role that I appreciated, having been a synodical bishop. You're close to congregation, you're close to the ministerium, the pastors. Now, here, and he said, you are the national expression of this church that we need in really ecumenical sense, in the political sense, you're mm-hmm. to be the expression of that church, to carry that and what the church stands for.
So how many synods were there?
Five.
There were five synods, each of which had a bishop. Yeah. And you then are, you know, if we were to use old Christian language or church language, we could consider Canada a city. You would be a metropolitan. Mm-hmm. Or if we consider it a national church, you would be a patriarch.
Or an archbishop.
Archbishops are usually over a smaller group. You were over all of them here in Canada.
Or the Archbishop of Sweden.
Yes, that's true too. They use that term in those. In some churches, you're correct. So he said to you that you are an expression and that expression is important for the church in terms of ecumenical work. It's important politically.
Yeah.
It's a point of contact.
And to kind of also give that expression of the whole church to within. Mm-hmm. So when you travel, you're mm-hmm. giving that expression mm-hmm. that you're more than synodical. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Were there examples in your time as national bishop which you can point to in retrospect, where you gave that expression in a way that sort of stands out for you?
Well, I think I did that in the ecumenical arrangement. Now there is someone else is chosen as the ecumenical officer, which makes sense in some regard because I was the ecumenical officer, basically. I chose that because I felt that I was probably the best one able to do it, and I was scared to represent our church in that sense. But I would be relating to the ecumenical officer of the Anglican Church, and we would be organizing our meetings together and so forth, which may have sounded strange to some people, but I was most comfortable in that kind of thing because I felt that was my I was kind of the expression of the church in terms of the expression, but also having some responsibility to represent our church in that area of this, along with others who would sit representing the church. But I coordinated that and supported those who were representing our church.
So you were directly involved then with the National Council of Churches?
I was president of the National Council of Churches, Canadian Council of Churches
for a term. And then also internationally?
Yes, I was Lutheran World Federation.
Right.
The World Council. For the World Council of Churches, I attended. At that time, I was president of the Canadian Conference. And so I coordinated we would meet together at the event. And so I was the one who did that as the president of the conference. So that was enriching. I think my first attendance at the World Council of Churches was as a visitor in Vancouver.
Oh, mm-hmm.
That would be 83.
I was there too.
Wow.
I was there as part of the delegation of Archbishop Sotirios of the Greek Church, because I was doing some work on Orthodox liturgical life across the country. And I had met with him, and he invited me to come as part of his delegation so I could talk to other Orthodox, Coptic, Armenians, and various others there. So that was the first and only time I've ever been in such a setting, but I may have had coffee across the table from you then. This experience of both the Canadian Council of Churches, which brings together a large body of Christian churches, not all of them. There are some that don't participate for a variety of reasons. And then also the Lutheran World Federation, which puts you in touch with Lutherans all around the world. Not all of them are Swedish. I'm sure all of them wish they were, but they probably aren't. And then also with the World Council of Churches. What did that do to your understanding of the church, your way of thinking about the church?
Well, it enhanced my view and understanding of worship in a way that I was just blown away by the worship at Vancouver. The richness of it and the beauty of it. I think it's a great, great influence of the Orthodox in the appreciation of worship through the World Council of Churches. That profound, profound thing. When it is done well, when in our music God is glorified as though the whole creation cried.
Mm-hmm. And of course it draws on the Psalms so deeply.
Yeah. That's when we discuss theology, it's another matter. It's a head thing and it's a dividing thing and it's a story of once heard of a once told this way that once a beautiful rock came and landed in the world and it was so beautiful. Where did it come from? I don't know, but people would walk around it and admire it. And then they decided we should write about it. We should describe it. Mm-hmm. And so they got their best scribes and intellectuals to come. And they wrote, "What is this rock?" And then they were trying to agree on the common description of it, but couldn't. So they ended up fighting and walking away. And then people determined that it's a divisive thing. That's just, and it grew over.
Yeah.
And but ever so often, a seeker would come and go in there, move some of the branches and see it and rush away in just absolute amazement.
The last few days, I've had an Orthodox Archbishop with me. He's moving to the end of his life and has lots of struggles. But in one of our conversations, he mentioned, I think it's a theologian in the Orthodox Church, a woman, who has said to him on several occasions, the Orthodox Church has a marvelous recipe, but it never bakes the bread. So, I mean, it's pointing in some extent to this difficulty, and it's not peculiar with the Orthodox Church, but that's a strong story. So what is the rock? Let's walk around that a little bit. It gets argued about. There's this secondary world of theological reflection, which is wonderful. I mean, I love theology and its marvelous capacities and its intricacies. But of course, it is also, it has led in periods of history, it has led people into very dark places. You, at the center of it, at least in some sense, most Christians would say, is a person, is Jesus Christ, the incarnation, the fullest expression of what it means to be human. Mm-hmm. And as we would say in the Christian East, all we really know of God.
Well, Mark's gospel is, here's the good news. And it's the word became flesh,
And that God loves you and you're not made for alienation.
But the Trinity, I mean, that's a try to explain. To me, people will understand God as the God of creation, the Creator, and what that means. People are very much. And then Bishop Stendhal, who was bishop in.
Stockholm.
Yeah, he was with us at a conference in Banff recently, and he was saying, you know, more and more I love Jesus. I come to preach. This is a theologian, you know, this is the reality of that. And then I come to think of energy and Stendhal wrote the book for this, the World Council of Churches meeting in Australia. And he was writing on the Holy Spirit. And I think the theme was Come Holy Spirit.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I don't want to speak about power, but I want to speak about energy.
Mm-hmm.
And that to me is energy. It's always there in the world. It is what's brought about life here. Energy, mm-hmm. energy. How is that? And I have come to think of prayer as energy.
Mm-hmm.
There's energy of God in the world for wholeness and life together. And what is this energy of the human mind, the energy of thought, the energy of being in touch with that reality of creation, in the life of Jesus and the sacrament and the spirit, wind blows where it is. I love the wind. I love the wind and the thought of energy. So it sounds like I'm a mystic, but
Energia is a central concept in the theology of the Christian East. It's central.
Yeah.
We see it expressed initially in Pseudo-Dionysus, the Cappadocian Church Fathers. It reaches its fullest expression, I think, in Maximus the Confessor. And one of the things that that they all say is that the whole cosmos is the energy of God. It's not the essence of God, that's dangerous, but it's the energy of God. It's the delight of God. It's the play of God. And it is grace. Grace is another word for it. Grace is another word for it. So it's a beautiful way of understanding things. And of course, in their understanding, this ancient understanding, which belongs to the whole church, of course. It's not about the Eastern Church. It's about what it means to be human and what it means to live in the world. The whole issue then is, how do we, as human beings, misunderstand that energy or take it for something which it isn't? Mm. That's sin. That's where the alienation comes from. So you mentioned the gift of worship that you saw at the World Council and that you saw in your work to realize just how the whole of the human family has these ways of worshiping which are so beautiful. Part of the gift of the liturgy from this perspective is it gives us an opportunity to move back into the energy of creation, to come out of our little tributaries or the whirlpools we've gotten caught in, and to move back into and draw near to God's grace in the world and to the wonder of it all, to the sheer wonder of it all.
Well, you know, we have such variety of worship right now. It's experimentation to some extent what evolves, and we know what works in community churches that, I think there's a Lutheran church in Arizona that is called Community of Joy. And I attended there on Easter Sunday with Trudy. And left it wanting to find the cry room. I was so disappointed, but it was a new way of joy, of trying to involve people. And what they do besides worship may be far more, but it was with no singing. We sang one chorus, one brief scripture passage. It was for a new kind of way of people come in and you sit and you can enjoy the performance. There's a special singer, and we could take her home with us because there were tapes that we could buy afterwards. It was so disappointing to me, but other people came, sat. They were parking lot attendants in and out. It was amazing.
Well, our world loves spectacle.
Yeah, but I grew up in this country church. I never saw the pastor when we came in. Never saw the pastor. We sat, waited, and then the organist, my aunt, would play, and we'd all start singing. And the last verse of the song, the pastor would come from the sacristy and kneel at the altar. and then turn and say, the Lord is in his holy temple. Mm-hmm. His throne is in heaven. He's near unto them who are a contrite spirit. He hears the supplication of the penitent. Inclineth to their prayers. Let us draw near with boldness.
Let us draw near with boldness.
And then we were into a communion liturgy, which could vary a little bit from the common service to the Augustan service, but it was contemplative, and it was hard to sing the hymns because we were not, it was hard work. But the quietness and the beauty of it. And now, as some retired pastor once, who was being honored at one of the synod meetings, said, yeah, I've grown up. I started with a Luther robe, and it was surplus and stole, and now we have something else, and I've gone through all of that. But I've also noticed that now we have a weather report when we come to church. We're issued, good morning. Trudy and I attend times, a couple times we've been in California to visit our daughter. And we've gone to this church and this pastor comes out, good morning! It wakes us up. Well, there's energy there, there's for sure. So I'm not sure if the contemplative spirit that I'm speaking of, where I know Trinity Lutheran in Edmonton, the people from Europe worship there, for the German service came 20 minutes, half hour beforehand, just sat. And now we come in the midst of activity, community. I don't know if it's worth trying to revive that, but I think the contemplation that maybe we just need to absorb that rather than a lot of activity. But it's something that rests the soul, that connects us into the presence. We need the presence of God, but also we need to be fully present.
They're not separate.
They're not separate.
They only exist in communion.
Right.
And where there is that, there is communion. But you point to, it's so curious to me. You know, I was baptized at Messiah Lutheran Church, before it was called that, Camrose Lutheran Church, back in the old days. And so when they were celebrating their 100th anniversary, I went down there with my sisters, because we all had good memories of that church. We moved to Edmonton when I was 7, but we buried both my parents in Camrose. It was always our little Mecca. So we went to an evening celebratory service at Messiah, which was held for this 100th anniversary. They did a number of things. And as you know, Messiah has very good music program and choirs and what have you. And the service was particularly interesting to me because I went for this reason. I knew that they were going to sing through all of the service books, from the ones that were brought from Norway, through to whatever they're doing these days. So that evening, the place was packed. And of course, it's a singing congregation. It was fascinating. So they began with the old Norwegian hymn book. And over about 2 hours, 2.5 hours, worked through to the final iteration. And in all of them,
in all of these, the hymns they chose and the particular choir that led it, sometimes the choir would sing just themselves, but mostly it was congregational. Mostly it was the gathered ecclesia. That congregation lifted the roof off with all of these hymns, with all of these hymns, until we got to the last one. The last one was the worship band. We were standing. The music was unsingable because it wasn't about singing. It was about performance. It was like a rock group, a mediocre rock group. It was, to me, it was a bit heartbreaking because there was no lifting the roof off. There were a few older men standing, obviously, with grandchildren, and the grandchildren were bopping a bit, and the older men were trying to pretend to bop.
Yeah.
It was a bit of that. But outside of that, it was a performance.
Yeah.
Now, the opposite of presence, and when I say presence in this sense that our spiritual forefathers have taught us, it is communion in all of its forms. The opposite of presence is not absence, it's performance. It's being something, it's pretending at something as opposed to being there, being addressed by the wonder of it all, by the divine, and responding. So this is curious what has actually happened and the way in which there is this attempt. I view it in part as an attempt to mimic a culture of spectacle. At the same time, it's very curious to me in my little Orthodox church, my little ship of fools, as I often refer to it, as which has immigrants in it. It has many people who've come from other religious traditions. It's an Orthodox church that has its roots out of the Russian church historically, but it's the OCA, the Orthodox Church in America, so it has some independence. And it was the first Orthodox church to move towards English, and it did that back in the late 60s. In our little church, where the liturgy of St. John Chrysostom gives its shape and form, always and only, there's variety in it, but it's very formed, and it is a service of the worship of God. There's a sermon, but it's not central. What is so curious to me is to see, during COVID, over the last 3 years, the congregation has grown by at least 50%. One wonders why. The people that are coming from various evangelical churches, some of the Reform, some of the churches of the Magisterial Reformation. A lot of them are young. Some of them were not churched. I'm a little nervous about this because I think many of them are, it seems to me from my conversations, that some of them at least come because they want some sense of belonging. They want to, what they would say is, we want to find the original church, the apostolic church. You know, this is kind of propaganda images we speak about. Some of them come because they see the Orthodox Church as conservative, and they are fed up with what their churches are doing in connection with various modern, recent concerns. When I talk with them,
after listening and trying to understand what they're saying, I usually do try to help them understand that the Orthodox Church is not conservative. It is radical. It's about the root of things, and that there is no place in the Orthodox Church for ideological perspectives. It's above that. Does it exist in the Orthodox Church? You better believe it. Some Orthodox churches colonized by it? Yeah, of course. But it's not appropriate. But many of these people stay. And my sense is they stay, whatever their ideologies are, whatever the motivations might have been, whatever negative stuff was going on there, they stay, it seems to me, over time, because of the liturgy, because of the sobriety of the liturgy, because it is worship, it is using the scriptures, it is the Psalms, and because, as you have pointed out so eloquently, it is fundamentally contemplative. It is a place where there is room for you to wonder, where there's, where the words of the scripture bring out your own suffering and help you hold it up to the throne of grace for healing. So I mean, I've talked with Lutheran pastors and others. I do think that the experiment that's been run of trying to turn worship into a spectacle and mimic some of what we see in popular culture, maybe some of that will continue for a long period of time. Who am I to say? I don't know. But I do think that we now can take some measure of it, as I sort of heard you doing, at least by implication, some measure of it, and say, well, maybe that can exist some places and be fruitful, but it's a mistake to turn prayer into spectacle, to turn congregations into audiences at a performance. That's a different understanding of the ecclesia, that's for sure.
Yeah, I can. It's very, my personal appreciation is where I'm there and I'm not distracted by announcements that we stand or we sit and what we're going to do, we're going to sing that and so forth. And things that for me disturb the flow of it. Mm-hmm. And those become interruptions.
Yeah.
That, like the psalmist saying, Selah, you know, whatever that word means, you know. So it stops it. But it was for a purpose, I guess, in the Psalms that you, so one person said, no, that was where we have to get in tune the instruments, stop. But it seems to me the tuning is, there has to be retuned because we're interrupted. I'm interrupted. And we're, I like some Roman Catholic services that I've attended where the priest is certainly the center and there's sometimes less and lay involvement, but not getting in way too much.
Yeah, you point to something so significant, which is what is the rhythm of the liturgy? What is the kind of rhythm that makes it possible for us to draw near?
Yeah.
And I suspect for you, I mean, just a little bit we've talked here, your description of that childhood church where you would gather, You all knew your neighbors. You would be quiet. You would wait. You would wait. And then the music begins. And only at the, and you'd come together. You blend your voices, the good voices, the voices that are struggling, but all of them count. And they all are invoking. And then the pastor coming in with those beautiful words that you quoted. So that is the rhythm of the liturgy. And that speaks profoundly to the human mind and the human heart, the human soul. What's curious to me about this modern period where the spectacle has taken over is that some of the same people that want to do that would then also be very inclined to speak about the wonderful tradition they saw in Nepal or that they experienced on a reserve or something like that, without ever making the connection that traditional societies, make of what you will, the words and the deities that they are invoking, but there's a profound human sense of the rhythm of drawing near to the wonder of it all.
I don't go to hockey games, partly because they're costly, but also there's not a moment of freedom from bombardment of stuff.
Yeah.
visually, sound, in the break of the play, or it's all noise and so forth, which is what people seemingly can do. They can do with their phones, they can multitask. It's just such a busy, busy world. And maybe that seems to fit the pattern for people where they can go from one to the other, you know, multitask, and can multitask at church as well. They're not distracted. But we're not into the aspect of just profound appreciation for a silence, for reflection, and for being present before God who is present.
Would you give me, to conclude our conversation, this conversation, would you give me those words again that the pastor speaks when he comes in?
The Lord is in his holy temple. The whole world is filled with his glory. The Lord is nigh unto them who are of a contrite spirit. He hears the supplication of the penitent and inclineth to their prayers. Let us therefore draw near with boldness to his throne of grace and confess our sins.
Amen.
Thank you for joining us. In August of 1979, we opened the Spiritual Life Sacred Ritual Gallery at the Provincial Museum of Alberta. It was the first time the ritual life of a wide range of religious communities was the subject of a museum exhibition in Canada, and it was the fruit of my fieldwork within these communities and my first major exhibition. The great reformer, Martin Luther, had translated the Bible into German in the 16th century. He had taken exception to the book of James in the New Testament because of its emphasis on human work as part of the process of salvation. God's grace or human work? Luther had made grace the center of his theological reflection. When I put Luther's translation of the Bible in the section of the gallery on Lutheran worship, I opened it to the book of James, wondering if any Lutheran who visited the gallery might get my little joke. Several weeks passed, and I got a call from President Schoberg, expressing appreciation for the gallery and casually noting that he got the joke. I welcome your comments on the various themes in this podcast and invite you to visit our website. Contact details may be found in the program notes.